Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Well, today's Hip Hop Saved My Life is a biggie. Excuse the pun. It features broadcasting legend Louis Theroux. Yes, correct. We managed to get Louis Theroux on the podcast. He was kind enough to come and chat to us. Knows his stuff. Obviously, he's done documentaries on hip-hop. But also, as a journalist, he listened to hip-hop loads. Still does. As a journalist, interviewed loads of rappers. And even wrote into Hip Hop Connection, which he talks about on this episode. His book, Gotta Get Through This, is wicked. I read it, and it's great. So you should check that out. But before you do that, check out Louis Theroux on Hip Hop Saved My Life. Enjoy.
This is the Hip Hop Saved My Life podcast. Thank you for listening to the podcast. Hope you enjoy the podcast. Now sit back, because it's time for the podcast.
Welcome to Hip Hop Saved My Life. I'm here with Rupert.
Hello.
How are you?
Good, thank you.
You are in... are you still in month... Are you out of month one of...
Oh, the new baby?
Yes.
Yeah, just yesterday.
Just yesterday?
Yeah.
Was month, the end of month one. And
yes.
How's that been so far?
So far, so good.
And it's exciting because our guest today... this ties in. Our guest today is a... I hope you don't
know. Is a one-month-old baby.
Yes, yeah. Is a legend, a broadcasting legend. Oh, it's Mr. Louis Theroux. Hello, Louis.
Hello.
We are so delighted to have you on the show.
Oh,
thank
yeah.
you.
Nice thank
to
you.
Hear, nice to be here.
And to give you an idea of how delighted Rupert is, do you want to tell him?
Oh, yeah, we called our son Louis.
Really?
It's a good name.
That's so... Yeah, it's a great
yeah.
name.
It's
yeah.
a good name. Yeah,
it is a good name. Name.
But it's not in honour of me, he says... hopefully.
It is, yeah.
Yeah,
officially.
No.
Yeah.
No, we just like the name, but you obviously share the name, so.
Yeah.
Yeah, if you'd have been a horrible person.
It was between that and Romesh.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Thank
it's
you.
Not so, yeah, it's not so much that we named him after you, but you You've being got... a dick didn't stop us from using the name. Kind of.
That's exactly, I guess that's, yeah, yeah, that is. Yeah.
That's the level of compliment. Like, it wasn't. You weren't so off-putting that we
yeah,
decided
exactly.
not to choose a name that we really
yeah.
liked.
Yes,
go.
Yeah. I'm looking at you very enviously because the last time I saw you, we were doing, we were on BBC Radio 2.
Radio 2, yeah, Zoe Ball's show.
Yes, and since then we have switched facial hair position because you were fairly, you had stubble.
I had a bit of stubble.
But now...
I've gone full bore Taliban.
Yeah. And I was Taliban then, and now I've de-Taliban. So what's is this a decision or laziness?
I know that I'm sort of off duty when I've got a beard because I don't do TV with a beard. It's a weird rule.
You would never ever do TV with a beard.
I wouldn't say I wouldn't. I would never do one of my own documentaries.
Right.
Or have never. I probably wouldn't ever. And that's a decision I made. And so so really the only times I shave kind of. In a disciplined way is when I'm filming, and the rest of the time. So how long my beard is usually an index of how long it's been since I filmed anything.
Right.
So I'm officially kind of off duty.
That was a conscious decision to not to do a documentary with a beard. You said you decided that. Is
I
that
think
just an aesthetic
on,
thing?
Or I think early on I felt as though there needed to be some sort of sense of uniformity. When I started out, I was an admirer of. People like Gilbert and George, the artists.
Right.
Do you know who I mean?
Mm.
And they wear the same suits,
yeah.
tailored suits, every day and have done as part of their art
yeah.
for the last 50 or 60 years. And there's something in that kind of strange, slightly bonkers level of consistency and dedication that I admired. And for a while I thought I'd like to wear a uniform when I made my TV programmes. Do you know what I mean?
Did you have any idea what that
something
might be?
Kind of slightly... ascetic and kind of quasi-revolutionary, like a Lenin jacket or
right.
a Mao cap or something. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Something that sort of said, like, I'm no frills. There's nothing silly about me. I'm in a kind of war mode. which I think new doesn't make any sense. Imagine that, someone turning up to an interview wearing a Mao cap and carrying a little red book. But I sort of thought, there's something that, about that, that appealed to me.
Right.
And in fact, Attenborough kind of does that. Yes. Because he always wears his blue cambray shirt, doesn't
yes.
he? And I thought, the less distracting you are, the less there is, the less frills and fripperies. But anyway, I never did that. So the closest I did was just always shave and try and keep some kind of consistency.
Well, as a stand-up, one of the things is your clothing can't be distracting. You know, when the big mistake is if you wear a T-shirt with some sort of slogan on it or something like that. Because Jaguar Skills, the DJ, I don't know if you're aware of his work, but he brought out this range of T-shirts where he'd taken classic hip-hop albums and incorporated Phil Collins into them. And so one of them was the cover of Wu-Tang's first album. And on the front, you know, it's all the guys with the masks. It's all of them with masks on. And the front guy is replaced, his face is replaced with Phil Collins. And it just says Ghostface Filler. I wore that at a gig. And somebody said afterwards, I couldn't focus on anything you were saying. Because all I thought about is, I can't believe Ramesh is into Phil Collins. So, yeah, but I really like your beard.
Oh, thank you.
It's really nice.
Thank
yeah.
you.
Do you think I could wear
it and make a program, or people would just
100%.
Think you yeah, people would just watch and think like, hang on, Louis got wearing a beard. And no
I
one wants that
so...
in their head, do they?
Yeah, I don't know. It's yeah. I mean, it'd be bad if they thought you were just wearing a beard. That
right.
would be that would
What's
be.
What's the
weird.
Verb? What do you do?
I don't know. Sporting.
Don't say sport.
Sporty.
There's nothing sporty. If your idea of
carrying?
Sport is
carrying
a beard around,
yeah.
you need to get out more and get more exercise. We've been applying for an Olympic event.
Yeah.
Okay, what is it? Wearing a beard.
Bearding.
You're in book promo mode now.
Yes,
right?
I am, yeah.
Your book, Got to Get Through This.
Yes, thank you.
It's very great,
good.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
It's very
I good. Didn't think of it, but I chose it.
Yeah, it's very nice. Well, first of all, congratulations on the page count.
Oh, yeah.
It's over 400 pages.
I'm afraid so. I wanted to get if I had more time, I would have made it shorter.
Right.
Yeah. I mean,
really?
Yeah, in all seriousness, I sort of think... when I look through it now, I think I could tighten that. I have an almost, it's almost a pathological need to tighten. You know, with programs, sometimes I over-tighten and over-cut. So it may be that I'm wrong, but I look through it and I think I could have. I took 20,000 words out quite late in the day, and I think I could have got another 10
the
out.
Publisher's...
No, my own.
Your
I
own.
Said, like, I think it's too long. It was 145 or 155.
That 155, is long, isn't
yeah.
it?
And
so I said that as an insert.
155,000 words.
Yes, yes. Mm.
And
because normally they're about what 90.
Anything above 80 is considered acceptable.
90. Yours.
Mine was absolute bottom limit. I think it was like 82 or something.
Sort of like just a
bigger
on
font
finish line and said, yeah.
"You not do the bigger font trick."
Bigger font.
No, well somebody. No, there is big. The font's huge on mine. But yeah,
so I went in and I said, "Here it is. It's 155. I think there's quite a bit that could be tightened and cut." And they said, "Pan Macmillan." Said, oh, no, I don't, you know, we love it and it's all good, which was not what I wanted to hear, actually. Because
sure.
I knew that it could be improved. So anyway, long story short, I ended up getting some friends to read it and sort of finding some chapters that could go.
Can I ask, because it's really detailed. You seem to remember everything. Like the level, I was very impressed by how in-depth you go into everything. Was that difficult?
Some of it obviously is supported by... going back to the program, so a lot of the it started out as being a kind of greatest hits of my journalism, like documentary work. Mm. So I'll write about the most hated family in America.
Yeah.
I'll write about Jimmy Savile. I'll write about all the programs I suppose I'm most associated with, and then I thought, well, I better get that. You know, people want a bit more behind the scenes than that. So I was supporting it with how we came to the idea and what the experience of filming was like. And then when I showed it to people, and when I read it back, I found I was more interested in the sort of behind the scenes stuff. So then I built that up, and then I showed it to some more friends, and it was like, you need to make it more personal. So then I put more personal stuff in, and then I began taking out quite a bit of the journalism. This is way more detail than you need.
No, this is good. Me. No, this is exactly the level of detail I was asked
so,
about.
So then, it's useful for my book.
Yeah.
So then when I was doing the stuff that... So it remains about half and half, half sort of journalism, which I went back to look at the programs and so wrote descriptions and kind of, added colour and transcribed dialogue. And then with I had diaries to support some of it. I went back to emails and then some of it I just... I sort of did my best impression of how... I remembered it. I think you've got to do that a bit.
Yeah.
Sorry about that.
What the...
I thought it was.
Is that your text notification?
What is a news notification?
Oh my god!
I got a new phone yesterday. Congratulations!
You haven't figured out how to switch it to silent.
No, I haven't yet.
Well, congratulations on the new
phone. That was the producer saying that Lou's been really boring.
Yeah, I just released a button.
The bit that I'm about halfway through it, and it's
thank you.
It's great. You're just naturally so fun in it. I mean, I mean, you've just talked about rewriting stuff, but it just it's effortlessly funny. I'm really enjoying it. A couple of the bits that really stuck out. Well, first of all, at the very beginning, you talk about going to this central eating.
That's right.
This,
yeah.
And one of the things that I really related to was this. Where you're talking about one of the rules is you're not allowed to touch genitals.
That's right.
So it's all about the sensuality of the actual eating and stuff like that. That's how
and massage and upper body touch.
Yes, right. So you're sort of describing what's happening there, and there's one bit where you said you were sort of a bit nervous about what was going on, and you felt a little bit out of your depth, and you looked across to the director. Yeah. And he was just completely focused on the camera.
Yeah, his eyes were clamped.
Just that. I totally related to that, being in a horrible situation. And then you look to the crew to see if anybody's
going on. What's actually happening here?
Yeah.
Have I been set up?
Hello.
And he's like, no, it was poker face. I still don't actually know. I think that's a sign of a good director in a way, someone who sort of knows how to slightly do you over in a very nice way.
I know what you mean. You have got to be, because actually when you're in those situations, the crew are your connection with getting out of this. You know, you're getting out of the immersive nature of what you're doing. And so actually they're bad for you in a way. Do you know what I mean? It's sort of better to be in the moment. And if they don't give you anything, it's actually good, but it feels horrible in the actual moment.
Yeah, what you don't want. I remember when I was making my Scientology movie, most of the clashes which I had with my director, who wasn't used to wearing... He was a wonderful guy called John Dowen. He wasn't used to working with a presenter. So he was used to sort of being the one who steps in when the Scientologists were coming up and giving us aggro, or the police arrived, which happened a few times. He would sort of step in and wrangle it.
Right.
And I sort of said, like, John, that's my job. That's why I'm here.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm supposed to be the guy who wrangles.
Yeah.
Like, I don't really have a lot else to do, to be honest with you. So if every time it gets a bit heated and starts kicking off, you pop out from behind the camera and say, I'll take it from here.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a little bit undermining.
The other thing you talk about was when you got involved with Michael Moore.
That's right.
And you got invited to go out and do this piece, and you just had no experience.
I had no clue. Yeah.
From your interview with them, were you interviewed with Michael Moore? Yeah. He just basically took a shine to you, I guess.
Yes. He had to have someone who was British, right?
Right.
Because the BBC was funding. He didn't have to, but the BBC was giving him a third of his money for his new show, TV Nation. And so I think he had mixed feelings about that, but he had a couple of his writers were people I knew and had worked with at a magazine called Spy Magazine, and they said, well, we know...
Chris Kelly,
yeah. Chris told Michael, we know a British guy, and he's quite funny, and he's a journalist, and you should meet him. And based on the interview, I think what happened was Michael liked the idea of me not having a clue, and I think he liked the idea of me sort of... Basically, I don't know. I think you could put it two ways. One was that he didn't enjoy people who might in any way lord it over him. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
he didn't want anyone coming in with a lot of attitude. I also think he liked the idea of someone being completely indebted to him. That was sort of non-threatening, just absolutely abjectly appreciative. Do you know what I mean? Which I was. And then maybe as well, he saw something in me that the idea of me being a bit, I don't know, sort of bookish and I don't know how else to characterise myself, sort of spindly and guileless, and throwing me in at the deep end with these sort of slightly scary, weird people in the American fringe.
Yes,
based on that, having no TV experience, he said, fine. And I became a correspondent on a network TV show, which, on the one hand, was a huge blessing, but at the time, you know, certainly in hindsight, and then at the time just felt massively terrifying.
Yeah.
Did you want to do that? Did you want to
be a presenter?
No, I never thought... You sort of fell into it.
Yeah, no, I hadn't aspired to do that. I wanted to be a TV writer. I thought, I could write sitcoms or funny questions, or... I didn't think, I can be on TV as an interviewer.
And so I felt massively unqualified. And I didn't feel I was it.
Yeah. Is it weird now? Because like, you are basically so like, people love the way that, you know, you know this, but I mean, I don't know how much you're conscious of it, is how your documentaries are like the creme de la creme. That's what, you know, you're the person that everybody reveres. You're sort of national treasure status, yeah. I would say, aren't you? And are you aware?
It's nice of you to say that.
Well, it's definitely true. And it's sort of, I think it's because you just do things your own way. I mean, you are a very particular, I think that those things that you talk about that may, at the beginning, this is from my point of view as a fan, like, that may have initially looked like that you weren't suited for TV are exactly the reasons that you are so great at what you do, you know?
It's weird because when I look back, what I mainly see is an inability to do things. So, for example, one of the things that used to freak me out was the idea of doing a piece to camera. And I used to find it quite frightening, the idea of, like, looking into a machine and talking to it as though it was a person.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know if that's... I think that's probably not that uncommon. Yeah. It felt the most unnatural.
No, I can't.
Some people take to it.
Yeah.
And I can sort of do it now if I almost as an impersonation.
Yeah.
Hello and welcome. You know, like, you have to sort of do a weird cadence and intonation. And here we are.
Yeah.
But if you try and talk to it like it's a normal person, it just doesn't work. And so I would avoid... In Weird Weekends at the beginning, I thought, well, I'd better do some pieces to camera. And none of them felt at all right.
Right.
They didn't work at all. And then actually looking back, I think that's probably quite good that we didn't use any. You know, it was something about sort of not acknowledging sort of the artificial nature of, or rather acknowledging it. You know, like actually saying, like I'm not going to pretend that the camera's not here, but I'm not going to talk to it.
Yes.
Anyway, that's a roundabout way of saying, I've done things my own way, more or less because there was no other way that I knew how to do it.
Right, yeah.
I don't know, I look back, and the book is kind of about this in a way, I look back at the success that I've had with a great deal of gratitude and a kind of weird feeling of fraudulence because, first of all, I'm aware of how much their group endeavours, right, which I talk about in the book, you know, the directors, the producers. In a sense, on occasion, I was the least clued up person on set. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
I was the sort of last to the party on set, in some respects, in terms of what was funny or what was going to work. At the same time, I'm also aware, looking back, of how I'm a kind of logo, or I think I've been the beneficiary of enormous amount of recognition and goodwill, partly just because I'm on camera. It goes without saying, but there's at the risk of stating the obvious, there's so many documentary makers who are far more talented and capable than I am, but they're just directors. They're behind the scenes.
Yeah, yeah.
I
know what you mean.
So yeah. It's all a bit of a con in a way.
Well, I did a travel show and I had to do online social media promo. One of the things they said to me was, oh, Louis did this thing that went massive where he just stared into the camera for, like, was it 5 minutes or something?
Yeah,
like that?
I think it was 5 minutes.
So they said, so we want you to do something similar. So I said, oh, okay, what do you want me to do? And I said, can you smile for 5 minutes into the camera?
Oh,
right? So so I basically, in agony, like, smiled into the camera for 5 minutes.
Was this like a live stream thing or something?
No, it's just clipped it up and put it out on the BBC. Because Louis, your one had gone massive or something.
I didn't even know that.
Right, so it had done. And then... And my, I think it got retweeted once, and that might be by my mum. I mean, it went.
No,
well, but that's not easy to smile. That's a whole.
No,
different...
I did it, but I mean, it's just.
Didn't it hurt your face?
Yeah,
don't
it
you
did,
start
it
like shake the muscles? There?
Yeah,
start,
they did.
Sort of
it felt like fake. It felt like my face fake. Was really vibrating, but they weren't reacting, so I assumed that it wasn't visible. I've never watched it back.
That sounds like a punishment.
Yeah.
One of the things that I'm a prima donna about. When I make documentaries is I'll do noddies on occasion. I don't really like to do them, cutaways of me listening, you know, which is normal in TV. And then once or twice I've been asked to laugh in a cutaway, right? Have you ever
so
been asked
unnatural.
To do that?
I haven't actually, no.
And he did it once or twice. And then after
it's horrible.
I felt so wrong. Yeah, I felt really awful. And I got quite angry about it. I was like, I'm never doing that again. No, it just felt really weird.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's really close cousin to like crying in a cutaway. You're like, now, can you cry in the cutaway? which happens in broadcast news. Have you ever seen that film? And that's the William Hurt character cries in his cutaway.
Right.
Just to show how sad and moved he is. It's sort of evidence of the most kind of corrupt kind of TV making.
So what people might not know, well, actually they might know about you, is that you're a hip-hop fan.
Yeah.
And I watched a thing recently where you talked about your playlist, and you made me listen to Post Malone, basically, because you talked about what you listen to at the moment, and you said, I'm listening to Post Malone, and you sort of were saying, you described it as a guilty pleasure, but then backed down from that.
Yes. I don't know why it would be a guilty pleasure.
Well, because of how he looks, I guess.
He's got tattoos on his face, which is a big thing now.
He's got a strange vibe about him, isn't he?
Well, here's the thing. I'm a fan of Post Malone, but if you Google him or if you look him up on Wikipedia, he got into a spot of bother about a few years ago. Do you know about this?
No.
Because he was obviously working in a hip-hop related genre, and then he was once asked, I feel bad for even dredging this up, he was once asked which other rappers he admired, and he said, or maybe he wasn't even asked, but he volunteered that he preferred Bob Dylan.
Oh yeah, I did see this. Yeah.
And it was a bit of a feeling of like, hang on, not only are you doing rap and hip-hop, but now you're going to say you don't really like, or you don't like it as much as you like Bob Dylan. And I think the feeling was, that's not cool, man. And then he apologised and he backed off it.
Yeah. But I, basically, when I was on holiday, when we're in the pool, I'm in charge of music.
Yeah.
And my wife and kids hate everything I like, basically. And so,
You're pretty much. It's lucky that you're allowed to play, you know, the music.
Yeah, I know.
I'm not allowed to DJ.
Well, it was only until I started playing Post Malone that the family got on board, because there's something. He's just he can write a catchy hook, that guy. I mean, it's incredible, isn't it? I've become a Post Malone fan because of you.
That's good, because he is good. And actually, the one that I first noticed was called Rockstar, which he rhymes Rockstar with Morrison.
Yes,
and which is kind of amazing, because he says it so that they actually do rhyme.
Yeah,
when he Martha Rasta, he can do that if you slur.
That has happened a lot more. That happens a lot now. Like, because when hip hop first, you know, early hip hop, all of the rhymes were like hard rhymes. Yeah. You know,
full rhymes.
Yes, full rhymes. Yes. Whereas now, like there's this album. I think it's last year, Jedi Mind Tricks, and there's this track that I really love on it. I can't remember what it's called. Number 5, right? And and I was really listening to it loads, and it was only like when I really started listening to it that I realised that not a lot of the words are actually right. It was all in the pronunciation of what he was doing. That it sound, and there's loads of that now,
which is good. I think in a way, in the early days of hip hop, people like Big Daddy Kane, who was rhyming like constantly, but with the result that sometimes it didn't make no sense, but he wasn't saying very much.
I know exactly what you mean.
And when you saw it written down, it would sound so good, and you see it written down, you're like, this, he's not saying an awful, he's like, there's a lot of rhyming and not much actual meaningful content.
It's
like Cole Porter, you know what I mean? When you rhyme certain show tunes, you rhyme that much, you're going to struggle to say anything of any significance.
Rakim and Big Daddy Kane were the ones that really made that kind of, because before them it was all at the end of the lines, wasn't it? And then they started having all these within the lines,
internal rhymes. And then Biggie Smalls would do it as well. Although he was so gifted that he could actually say something and still be rhyming every third word virtually.
Yeah, whereas with, I know what you mean, with Big Daddy Kane and Rakim, you listen to some of it and you go, actually, it's quite abstract. I'm not sure of the point that's being made here.
Nice and smooth like that, right?
Yeah.
Like really silly.
And then Eminem got to a stage where he basically rhymes entire lines with, you know, he'll get it with every word of the line will rhyme with every word of the next one, which is it's impressive.
And then sometimes Big Daddy Kane would use words and you weren't sure if you knew what they meant. Do you remember this one? I think it's called Another Victory, and he goes, some of the product you sold was real dangerous and all the message you sent was miscellaneous. I don't think miscellaneous was the word you were looking for. Because all the glamour you get is miscellaneous, and all the product you sell is real dangerous. Like let's say I'm poison. Destruction to all your own boys and girls that like to buy and give it a try. My, they can't, they're not a high, that's why they soon die. It's something like that. It's not really a direct quote, but it was the rhyme.
So what you're saying is, it's helpful to sort of soften that rule on the rhyming, just so you can make a bit of sense, basically. You mentioned in the book that you, years ago, wrote into Hip Hop Connection.
Yes, I did, yeah.
King
Louis.
King Louis.
Because all the letters came from people with sort of hip hop style name, so I felt I had to give myself a rap moniker.
Was that LOU-E?
Or? Yes, it was. Yeah. LOU-capital E.
Yeah, there you go.
And in fact, the backstory to that is that you're probably a bit younger for
no,
Hip Hop Connection.
Hip Hop Connection, I loved Hip Hop Connection.
It was a monthly, and I used to, every time it came out, I loved it. Mm. And they would, you know, they would cover US artists, obviously, and then have a few pages about what was going on in British hip hop, and regarded it, I suppose, as their job to you know, support the local scene.
Yes, it was a
early
sense of
days,
duty,
yeah.
Wasn't it? To sort of,
but
yeah.
but the scene wasn't what it is now, and so a lot of the artists perhaps weren't all that good, quite honestly.
Or doing that impersonating American rappers.
Yeah,
or
hadn't found their voice. So
we're talking about, like, you mentioned in the book, Derek B.
Derek B.
Bad
was
young
not
brother.
Very good. Derek B. Have you ever listened to Derek
Actually,
B?
Actually, he's got some bad rhymes there.
But Derek B. was guilty of that. Demon Boys also. I preferred Demon
Boys.
Demon Boys
had a couple of good tracks.
Yeah.
Recognition.
Yeah.
Recognition. Yes, or realize. Open your eyes, because I got a surprise.
They were pretty good. And then I mentioned Silver Bullet. He was good. Well,
I
he's another one where you look at the lyrics written down and...
Yeah.
What was that? Oh, 20 seconds to comply.
Yeah. An evil structure, a terror conductor.
He was probably the best, I think.
Yeah.
So, but I remember buying a couple of albums and thinking, these aren't up to much. And feeling a bit annoyed.
Oh, based on...
Based on the recommendation
right,
in Hip Hop Connection. So I wrote into Hip Hop Connection to complain and say, what, you know, why don't we... He said one or two things, and then it ended by saying, face it, if UK rap was any good, it would speak for itself. British rap sucks.
Yes.
It's strong, but anyway. It's
quite admirable because Hip Hop Connection was so worthy about the British hip hop scene.
Yeah.
And I totally get why. Well, I'm not criticising Hip Hop Connection for that, but I get what you're saying. But for you to just... I mean, you were really very much going against the sentiments of the whole publication.
Yes, this whole race.
I mean, it was brave. It was
like riding into Auto Weekly and saying, like, cars pollute the environment. It should be banned. I don't know what reception I was expecting.
You got slaughtered, right?
I got slaughtered. They published the letter and then in the following issue said... The letters page was more or less turned over to critical responses. It's one which said, King Louis, dope name, pity about you being such a fucker.
There you go.
And then it was a lot of that was all like that. And then it was, this is just a small sample of the literally sack loads of mail we received in response to your letter.
How did you feel?
Felt quite good, actually.
Like a king.
Felt like a king. Yeah. Felt like I kept it real.
Yeah.
Felt like they needed to know. Thought they'd better recognise. And then I wanted to write back and sort of get a little correspondence going. And then I never bothered to. But I left it at that.
I did write something, because actually I think you were right. I mean, the UK hip hop scene, they were trying to big it up, and it wasn't what it is today. So you're right to say what you said, but it's just I did something. I wrote a letter into Hip Hop Connection, but it turned out I was wrong. I was so obsessed with East Coast hip hop, and I wouldn't listen to anything from the West Coast. So I just refused to acknowledge.
What years are we talking about?
This was like early to mid 90s, I guess.
Really? That's quite strange.
Yes. So it must have been about 93. So when The Chronic came out, and I wrote into HHC, and at that time Tim Dog had got a song out called Fuck Compton, which I don't know if you remember.
I do remember.
All you suckers that riff from the West Coast, I'll diss and spray ass like a roach. You think you're cool with your curls and your chains, I roll thick and you'll be yelling out rain. A hard brother that lives in New York, we're suckers are hard and we don't have to talk. Shut your mouth before we come out stomping. Hey yo, easy, fuck Compton.
And I was so into the East Coast scene. I wrote a letter into Hip Hop Connection about how shit I thought The Chronic was. Time has bore me out to be quite the prick on this. How shit I thought The Chronic was. How terrible I thought Snoop was.
Mm.
How
based great on what? I thought what Tim. What was your problem?
Because you just loved the East.
Just because I loved East Coast hip hop and I just didn't want to.
Why did you have to? I'm not trying to be adversarial. Why did you have to choose one, do you think? Why? Because was East Coast hip hop constantly going on about how shit the West Coast scene was?
No, well, not really. But I was so... Yeah, exactly. I think I might have started the whole East Coast, West Coast.
Sounds like you did.
Yeah. But I was just so into East Coast rap that it pissed me off. I remember being pissed off that everybody was jumping on. But the thing is, I did listen to NWA and stuff like that, but just for some reason, Dr. Dre coming out with The Chronic and everybody saying it was amazing really fucking got my back up. I don't know why. Anyway, the worst thing was I was wrong and I didn't elicit the kind of levels of notoriety that you did. So I wasn't anywhere near as good as what you did.
At what point did you get on board with the West Coast?
Really shortly after I wrote that
letter. After that.
Did you?
That album.
I just sort of realised that I was being a bit of a... I was so narrow. I mean, there's a point at which I'd only listen to stuff that was off a certain street.
From DMD, it had to be DMD Studios.
Who were your sort of gods of among the MCs, if you like?
I mean, I loved Big Daddy Kane so much.
Did you?
Yeah, I just thought it was amazing.
That third album is perhaps one of the worst records I've ever bought.
Yes, yes.
Did you bring that home and think, oh, this is the new Big Daddy Kane album? I think it's called The Taste of Chocolate.
Here's another groove that I'm bringing to you, kind of mellow. And I just want to say hello, or should I say peace, as I start to release the poetry that don't cease, never the least. Your feet got to shuffle as I put the muscle in the groove. Sound so smooth. Once you experience the whole Kane rhyme, I'll have you dancing in a Soul Train line.
The album title is almost a warning. Just by the way, if you like my previous stuff, you're in for a bit of a shock. Because he sort of hinted to that side of things on his previous stuff. Then Taste of Chocolate, he just really...
He went for it.
I remember around that time I read an interview with him and they're like, who do you aspire to be? He's like, I want to be a cross between Marvin Gaye and Malcolm X, a sexy black performer with a political side or something like that.
Yeah.
Which is, I think actually, Malcolm X, good. But as much as I admire Marvin Gaye, I don't think that's someone to aspire to be in hip-hop.
No.
Mm. And so he's doing all these slow jams. I think the cover is him in a jacuzzi.
Yes.
And it's just... I think he'd lost Marley Marl as producer.
Yeah.
Is that what happened?
Yeah.
Because actually, you could probably get away with some weak raps if the beats are okay.
Mm.
Or maybe Mr. C had jumped ship. I don't know. That was his DJ, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was, yeah.
Still I don't know what happened, but that album was an absolute stinker.
Yes, it was. And he fell victim to the same thing that I thought LL Cool J fell victim to, which is doing too many of these... Like, when LL Cool J did I Need Love, and that went massive, he sort of started to make that his thing, and it really pissed me off, actually, because, like, LL Cool J was great, and then you start hearing all these kind of ballads and stuff like that.
That's what I'm talking about.
Yeah, trying
to do slow jams and sort of sexy songs. It just doesn't... It's not easy to pull off in hip hop.
No, it's not. And I would say I'd go further.
Around the Way Girl,
it's a mistake.
One,
Around the Way.
That one.
Do you remember LL Cool J doing that big old butt? I always sing that to my wife, where he just goes, "Lisa got a big old butt. I know I told you I'd be true, but Lisa got a big old butt, so I'm leaving you. See ya." And then. And then the song is just a succession of him leaving these different girls because someone else has got a big old butt. What happens is, it turns out he's into big old butts, but also that those big old butts have a shelf life.
Right.
And so he'll only be into the big old butt for a certain amount of time, and then he'll want to move on to a sort of a fresh
new butt.
It's that level of honesty that is one of the things I admire about him. Not, it's a bit the ability to go to a very authentic place.
Yes, sure.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
The The other thing that I found amazing that you did, which I, as I was reading it, I just sort of felt myself absolutely cringing, was when you were working at Spy and you interviewed a load of rappers about gun safety.
Yeah, that's right.
And I think this is Chris Kelly's idea.
Yeah, it was,
was for you to ask them to freestyle a rap about gun safety.
About gun safety.
Was this UK rappers?
No, it was American. This is in America, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was American rappers. And a couple of them actually went with it and tried to do it. There was, that was when I spoke to... So a couple of them refused. I think Sir Mix-a-Lot and Ice-T both said, oh no, I'd have to write that shit down, dude. Yeah. And or dog, and I think Schooly D refused.
Yeah,
I mean the thrill for me was just talking to the guys. Yeah. I remember having a long chat with Schooly D about how much I loved "Am I Black Enough for You" and my admiration. And he's like, "I'd never do another album like that again." I was like, "Why?" I said, "I had to pay too much for the samples." Like it was just sort of getting the back. I was like, "But that was a great album." Like I made no money on that record anyway. A couple of them actually did freestyle raps. Edo, do you remember Edo G and the Bulldogs?
Yeah, yeah.
So he did one, and then halfway through, so he went, "I like to clean my gun. It's a lot of fun." And then oh, shit, I can't do this. You know, which is exactly what speaking personally, like, that's what I would be like. But he's supposed to be a rapper. And then the only one who did it with sort of actual aplomb and did it for, was Fat Joe the Gangster,
right?
And he was obviously in a limo somewhere, and he had people around him, and he started going, "I knew a motherfucker who tried to slay me and play me and slay me and make it do a motherfucking rap about gun safety, but I just laughed and blast." And he just went on, and then he just went on about, I don't know, he slipped That's into great. Some normal verses.
Yeah.
A lot of rappers can't freestyle.
No,
I think it's
no,
almost
yeah.
like. There's a sort of, it's a bit like them being in the magic circle. There's a sort of secret which no one quite wants, maybe wrestling is a better comparison, where no one would really admit that there's probably not many rappers who can actually freestyle.
No, well,
for real.
The truth of it is, the ones that can really freestyle, you'd never really want to hear a record from, do you know what I mean? Because they're very good at doing stuff about
Lord of Finesse,
the stuff in the room.
Yeah.
Lord of like, Finesse. Yeah, and Supernatural MC used to like, there's loads of videos of him just sort of stood in like a shopping centre, and people are just coming up to him and he's just freestyling about everything around him and like what these people look like. And it's very impressive. But then he's not going to, you don't want to hear his album, do you know what I mean? And a lot of these things where I don't know how much he watches YouTube clips of guys going on Sway and doing the morning show and doing like freestyles and stuff on that. And most of those guys are not freestyling. They're doing stuff that hasn't been on a record, right? Yeah. Which is, and you sort of go, I don't care. I sort of think I don't care because it still sounds really good.
Yeah.
I'd rather hear this than them trying to stumble their way through a freestyle. But, you know, there's this thing where some rappers would go, if you can't freestyle, you're not a rapper. And that's just not true. It's just not true.
Have you ever been to it? I once was in Jackson, Mississippi, and went to a freestyle, what do they call it? It's a battle. And it's the same thing where the ones who are... Generally, the ones who win the rap battle are the ones who click into their pre-prepared raps quicker than the other ones, or just go straight to it. And a couple of them, you're like, well, that seems like he actually came off the top of the dome because he's referring to, you know, the buttons on his jacket or something. But usually those are the clunkiest rhymes, and the crowd doesn't really care.
No. I remember, like, I don't know if you saw Black... Do you know The Roots at all?
Yeah.
So Black Thought from The Roots, he did Funkmaster Flex's show. And he does a freestyle, and they start the beat, and he rhymes non-stop for 11 minutes. Like, it's without a break. He just goes straight. And, like, I know that's written. The lyrics are so dense and so clever and well-structured. There's no way that can be freestyle. But it's still unbelievable that he has that in his locker, that he can just go for that amount of time. It's just amazing.
That reminds me of a track I used to love. Do you remember Portrait of a Masterpiece by D.O.C.?
Yeah, yeah.
And trying to figure out what he was saying, and the sort of the sheer speed of it, the machine gun delivery of how he would come out with those verses. I've still never seen that written down. Maybe I'm afraid to, because I'll find out that it's just all nonsense.
Yeah. Let's take a trip, but not of the physical. Sense of direction on a keto statistical. Through a gallery of sorts, of course it's dope. Paying tough like the name on my rope. Watching me worry, a status of lyrical poise. A musical massacre of inadequate noise by the new authority. Because the majority of fears who hear will award superiority to those who
you remember him? And then he had a car crash and lost his voice.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
He came out with an album. Mm.
He was huge. Like
yeah. But do you... Because Post Malone obviously is not a lyricist. Do you?
No. I don't even know if he's a rapper.
I don't think... He gets described as a rapper, doesn't
not
he? But
really.
He doesn't really rap, does he?
He does that. It's a bit like... Again, like Drake, where it's that thing... Because so much is auto-tuned now that the line between rap and just singing is kind of... It's a bit... It's a grey area.
Yeah. Yes, yeah, yeah. But do you... You know, like... People, the accusation that people level at hip hop now, and I don't know how much you listen to. I mean, we talk about it in a set, but how much you listen to now, or what you listen to now. But do you agree with this sort of accusation that sort of that focus on lyrics has sort of gone away a bit?
Well, I don't think it has. I mean, I don't want to pretend that I'm across the scene.
Sure.
But in terms of, I see different things going on. You've got people like Kendrick Lamar, who's absolutely about
yes.
the lyrics,
yeah.
and I guess to an extent Kanye as well. And then you've got other rappers or younger people on the scene who I also quite enjoy. Sometimes they're called SoundCloud rappers, who just sort of almost revel in the kind of clumsiness and primitiveness of the lyrics.
Yeah.
Who's the one who goes Gucci Gang, Gucci Mane, is it?
Yeah,
Gucci Gang. You think like, my goodness, that's actually all he's going to say. That's his rap, which I kind of admire. I think to an extent, the self seriousness of a lot of old school hip hop, or people say like, oh, it's better back in the day, can be a bit tedious.
Yes, yeah.
And the younger people coming along, and you know, there was this thing, people saying fuck Tupac. Do you remember? Were you aware of that? It became a thing like. The younger generation was saying, like, I don't give a shit about Tupac.
Well, they're just not giving a nod
Tupac,
to the
founders.
Yeah.
And it was like,
founders.
Well, you just said what?
Yeah.
But the idea that Tupac should be kind of universally venerated suddenly gave way to the younger people saying, like, he's not talking about me in my life.
Yeah. And also the other thing is like, there's some. I think that this whole idea that anybody coming into the music scene should have a reverence for everybody that came before.
Yeah.
It's just such bullshit, isn't it?
It's really tedious.
I just think it's more exciting if somebody goes, I just don't give a shit about anything else that's happened before. Like, do you know what I mean? This is what I'm doing.
Yeah, there should be a little revolution every sort of 10 years or something, and people clean house. And then you go back and rediscover stuff, and stuff comes in circles, doesn't it? It was the same way when the South came along. Do you remember when there was like East Coast, West Coast, and then...
I started it, of course I remember.
Of course you did, you started it. And then meanwhile, the South came up and it was just like, we're just going to make party music
about
dancing and fighting. Mm. And it'll be just sort of loud music that you can just literally just kind of mosh around to.
Yeah. I remember being, I mean,
Little
in
John
the,
and stuff
in the
like
UK
that.
In particular, people were so snobby about when the South came up.
Yeah.
Because they're just like, what the hell is this, man? Do you know what I mean? Like, they're not, there's no multi-syllabic flows. They're not like, do you know what I mean? It's not all densely packed verses. And then eventually just people came around to go, oh, this is just stuff that you can put on and you can actually listen to it at a club or something like that. And it's,
It was when, I remember watching MTV, it would have been 20 years ago maybe, and Juvenile's Back That Ass Up came on. Although I think for radio play it was Back That
You are fine looking woman, man.
Yeah, it's a great, and it was just some. It was Manny Fresh production, and it had that sort of almost sort of violin synth sound that he specialised.
And who was it? What was the name of the all their album covers were done? Was it Pen and Pixel?
Yeah. Who I visited? Did you?
Yeah, I saw this.
I actually met that guy.
Didn't you spend some time in Master P as?
Yeah, I got to know Master P. Well, let's rephrase that. I met him and hung out with him. We were rather good friends, Master P.
I
called him Percy. Only few people get to do that. No, Master P, I visited at his house in Baton Rouge. He went bankrupt, or he didn't, but his company did a few years after that.
Yeah.
And then, but also in a scene we never used in the program, because that was around the time that No Limit, Master P's label, was sort of in eclipse, and Cash Money Records was on the rise. If you remember, Big Bird? No, that's Sesame Street.
Bird
Baby
Gang.
Bird.
Yeah.
Birdman.
Yeah, Birdman, yeah.
And And that was when Juvenile was on that label and a bunch of other Sea Murder was No Limit. Then
Sea Murder Masterpiece brother,
yeah, who got done for murder.
We got him.
Yeah.
Which
yeah.
is I don't yeah. know.
It'd be so embarrassing
ironic?
To be done for another crime.
Do you think so? Literally.
Sea litter.
No, I mean, anyway, so, but I went to, so Cash Money were on the rise, and that was just when Lil Wayne was signed to them.
Yeah.
And I visited, they invited us to see, to a film, to see them filming one of their videos. Why am I talking about this? Only because it was an extraordinary, Manny Fresh was there, yeah. had a chat, it was a sort of, again, it was a sort of amazing feeling of, wow, I'm getting to meet these legends. Of the scene, but the sense of sort of brio and how much talent there was, and just it's just weird to me as well. I had a chat with Lil Wayne. It didn't get into the cut because it just didn't really go anywhere. But he was a child. He was probably 15 yeah. years old. He didn't have dreadlocks. He had short hair. He was still in high school, I think. Who would
but
have
did
thought?
They know that he was going to be a star at that stage?
I think they must have known because he was a prodigy, wasn't he? And yeah. he used to contribute verses on all the records.
I think he was the one that people that weren't into that South scene
bought
into. Yeah. yeah, like he was just sort of, he transcended that, I think. You know, now he's a megastar.
He's someone who I think actually doesn't write down his raps and freestyles them in the studio.
Yeah.
Which I think sometimes is a tiny bit limiting, if I'm honest.
Well, it is limiting.
We're going to call him
I would
out.
Argue strongly. It's limiting, and also it's sort of it's fun. There's a couple of times where he just sort of the Carter Three, which I don't know if you've listened to, but it is a great album. But there's one bit that always bugs me, and he says something about a panel that is solar, and I'm black and I'm white, so I'm polar. And you think, what well, you that's the wrong bear. That is the wrong bear.
White panda.
And if you'd have written that down and just thought about it yeah. for a minute or so. Mm. You would have realised that's the wrong bear. Do you know what I mean?
Another one, maybe there's a thing of rap kind of misnomers or something where it's a my mind's playing tricks on me. That which is
Ghetto Boys.
Yeah. And he goes, and if I die, my child will be a bastard. Do you remember that? And
like, no.
If you, no? It might be a bastard.
I got a little boy to look after. And if I die, then my child will be a bastard.
I think you mean orphan.
Yeah. It's a weird one to get confused about, because I know people get confused by second cousins and stuff like that, but it's very rare that the confusion steps in where what happens if I die? Yeah.
Were you a fan of Master P's music before you met him, or wasn't? So.
I was more of a fan of Cash Money sound, if I'm completely honest.
Yeah.
I wouldn't have said I knew much of Master P's music. Yeah. Could you?
No, I know, I didn't really like any of it. Yeah. I found it impressive that he'd sort of created this kind of
He was a
empire.
Business phenomenon. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And then at the point where Suge Knight was sent down, he swooped in and signed Snoop to No Limit for sort of 10
Yeah,
albums.
I remember, yeah. And then,
so he had a lot of business
When
sense.
Snoop signed to No Limit, I just couldn't.
Couldn't get your head around
I couldn't believe it.
What are those records like? Have you listened?
There was the album that I quite liked, I think he did, I think that was a No Limit album, was one called Last Meal. And I think the reason he called it Last Meal was he said that was the last album he was ever going to put out on a label that wasn't owned by him. So it's sort of like, it's the last time you're going to eat off me. And it's good, yeah. I mean, Snoop's pretty, he's just brought out a new album, hasn't he? Mm. He's probably been pretty consistent.
He's unbelievable. Like, the level of consistency and the longevity that he's had is...
Got into a little trouble with Gazza recently. I don't know if you saw
that. Yeah, they had a beef.
What about?
Snoop did this... I don't think he was aware of who Paul Gascoigne is, but he put a photo up of Gazza, like, now, sort of... It's quite sad, actually. Gazza... A really bad photo of Gazza is sort of ravaged.
Mm.
And then a photo of himself.
Right.
And he's put... alcohol use over 20 years versus weed use over 20 years or whatever, and obviously people just went, what the fuck, man, that's like a really horrible thing to do. And so it's they, and then Gazza responded, didn't he said, I don't know who this idiot is or something.
Gazza must know who Snoop Dogg is,
yeah, but I think it's helpful for the beef to sort of
still to play out.
He did.
Well, they're both rappers.
He hit back, didn't he? He hit back. I can't remember what it was. He made fun of him in return. I can't remember what it was. Mind you, it's unkind, but there's something in that.
Yes, sure.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. But I think Snoop's blessed with great genes as well, because I've seen, you know, I know people from around Crawley that
smoke a lot of weed.
You smoke a lot of weed, and they haven't aged as well as Snoop.
Are you able to keep up with hip hop?
Not in any measure.
A little bit.
I mean, I'm constantly listening to new stuff, but if you listen to hip hop in any music, actually, it's sort of become disposable because of the way that we're consuming music, you know, through apps and stuff like that. God, I sound like an old prick. But the point is that you listen to something and just you move on, you listen to something and move on. And I think that you just have to make a choice about, well, I really like this album, so I'm going to stick with this. And if that means that I'm going to miss a couple of things or I'm not going to get to something till later on, then it just has to be. But I think it's impossible to be across everything. Loads of people come into this podcast and talk about artists that I've just got absolutely zero awareness of. And like, unless you made it your job to be across it. That's why I think, you know, like I went and did Lauren Laverne's show recently, and she's across all music, and her knowledge of hip hop was unbelievable. I've got no idea how you do it and run a life. Do you know what I mean? I mean, I know that's her job, but still, I think it's impossible.
And what do you think? I'm going to interview you for a second.
Sure.
All right.
Yeah.
So what the idea of hip hop saving your life, right?
Yes.
What was it in hip hop that you felt spoke to you, or that was important for you, or that you weren't getting elsewhere?
Well, I was at a school where there were very few ethnic minorities, and I remember listening to Public Enemy, It Takes a Nation of Millions. And I remember just thinking, there's some sort of this sort of identity politics of this. I didn't think those words, but there's something about that, you know, that kind of that anger and that sort of emotion of it. I just really it really connected with me, and then it just went from there, really. And then I sort of
that was the album for me,
yeah. And then I became everything I did, like dressed, how I spoke, but nobody else I knew that was into hip hop, so it was very out of context. It was sort of embarrassing actually when I look back.
Really,
at it. Yeah.
Were you, and then do you remember all the Professor Griff business?
Yeah, I do remember that, yeah.
And did that trouble you at all?
It did.
He was accused of being anti-Semitic. Yeah. I can't remember what it was.
He sort of said something about
But he was quite a strict Nation of Islam, wasn't he?
Yeah.
So he was on board with
the problem ideas. Is that he'd done an interview and said something about it's something alluding to Jews running the world or something. It was something like that. And then...
So something perfectly harmless.
Yeah, sure, exactly. And then Public Enemy did not distance themselves. They were terrible. Chuck D was awful. I wasn't expecting Flavor Flav to lead that charge, but yeah. Chuck D was terrible.
Terminator X.
He didn't talk.
Well, with his hands, he just spit with his hands. He just sort of shrugged.
Oh, Griff.
Oh!
Yeah, he could have done that.
His finger. But yeah, they just didn't distance themselves in a way that suggested. I remember thinking, this suggests to me that you agree with what Griff said. Mm. And they sort of broke up for a while, didn't they?
And then I can't remember which track it's in. He goes, apology made to whoever pleases, still they got me like Jesus.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You're like, I think you just doubled down.
Yeah, yeah.
I know. It was.
Do you remember Griff was on stage and he was supposed to be the militant one?
And then he had his.
And they were all called the Fruit of Islam, were they? Or was that something else?
No, there's the S1Ws.
S1Ws. And they would sort of march and do sort of dance march.
Yeah.
It was slightly fey, wasn't it?
Yes. Mm. Well, I went to see this Gods of Rap tour, and it was like Wu-Tang Clan, De La Soul, and Public Enemy. And Public Enemy came out with that. Because I remember going to watch Public Enemy like years ago, and they'd have like four or five of them, but they'd only brought two of them this time, and they were slightly portlier.
Yeah,
owning the stage.
It was a different experience watching them. Have you been to any live hip hop shows?
Not that many. I lived in San Jose for a while. I remember seeing Digital Underground.
Yeah, what was that like?
It was pretty good. And looking back on it, I'm constantly haunted by the idea that Tupac might have been.
He was in there. Yeah.
He was in their entourage, wasn't he? But I don't recall clocking him. And I saw Big Daddy Kane in Brixton. It was, in all honesty, not one of the best shows.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Anyway, weirdly, one of the best shows I ever saw was Arrested Development. Do you remember them?
Mm. Yeah.
Who were sort of pop rap, weren't they? They were thinking it was Mr. Wendell.
Mr. Wendell. I remember thinking Tennessee was unbelievable when it first came out. And that sort of singy rap thing, it was amazing. Mr. Wendell.
That's what it was. It was that singing and rapping.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they did an amazing show.
Really?
They may have had a live band. Maybe that helped. Sometimes you just don't have enough to look at. I saw Ultra Magnetic MCs.
Yeah. Mm.
They did a good show. But then their thing was that he was rapping over himself rapping. Yeah, did you ever see that, where they put the CD on and he just rapped over
it? I know, it's so crap. But the thing, you know, Arrested Development, did you ever think, when you listen to Mr. Wendell, he's so horribly patronising to that poor guy, isn't he? Do you know what I mean? Like, here, brother, have a dollar. In fact, no, have two. $2 means a snack for me, but it means a big deal to you.
Right.
So fucking horrible, that lyric.
Anyway. It's sort of, you mentioned Phil Collins earlier.
Yeah.
It's sort of the hip-hop version of Another Day in Paradise, isn't it?
Doing his bit.
Yeah, it is.
It's got a similar, slightly queasy. Yeah. You expect to go like, all the proceeds from this record are going to help the homeless. But they don't say that, like, no, they're not even doing that.
Yeah.
Mr. Wendell's a bum. It was an odd... It was like... It's an odd theme.
But a great show, that. Great show.
Great show, amazing show.
Hey, man, what's your favourite hip-hop album?
What would you say your favourite?
Well, I was thinking about it on the way here, and I think I'm going to say Low End Theory.
Right. Tribe
Called Quest.
Yeah. Yeah.
Hey, yo, Bo knows this, what? And Bo knows that,
what?
But Bo don't know Jack, because Bo can't rap. Well, what do you know? The Diddog is first up to bat. No batteries included, and no strings attached. No holds barred. Time for move faking, got to get to loot so I can bring home the bacon. Brothers front, they say the drop can't flow, but we've been known to do the impossible like Broadway Joe. So sleep
the
if you
production,
want,
the feel is so deep, and it just pays. It just,
do you like all of Tribe stuff?
No, but the first album, I it's like a lot of groups, I sort of jumped off the ship at a certain point.
Yeah.
The third album, maybe.
Midnight Marauders.
Yeah, Midnight Marauders I liked. There was one after that, maybe.
Oh, God, I know which one you're talking about. I had Stressed Out on it. And it was the first album that they put out that I thought wasn't essential.
Yeah. But I remember the first one, People's Instinctive Trolls and the Positive Rhythm, was great. And then I was going to give honourable mention to All Eyes on Me.
Right.
Which I, when it dropped, I loved. And, you know, the idea of a hip-hop double album. And
although that because that hip hop dub album works,
does,
but hip hop dub albums since, there's not a great tradition of hip hop dub albums.
Biggie's one, Wu-Tang's
second one was a double, wasn't it?
Biggie's second one, I was going to say Biggie's first one.
Oh my God, amazing.
Ready to Die.
Yeah,
and when those both came out, it was a moment where I thought, well, oh mate, am I out? Am I sort of? Do I still love hip hop? And then when those came out, I thought, oh wow, still happening. I think I just bought Eric B. and Rakim's sort of third or fourth album and thought, oh, this isn't happening anymore.
Yeah.
Let the Rhythm Hit Him, was it?
Yeah.
But then when those two albums came, and I thought, okay, this is really still happening. It's amazing.
And do you listen to anything, like, are you listening to any stuff now?
Well, mainly stuff that my kids put on. And it's kind of a little bit random. And some of it's, I mean, I liked... he's in a bit of legal bother at the moment, but I quite like Takeshi 69.
Yeah. Mm.
He's got one out at the moment called Kika that uses steel drums. That's very catchy. And he used to do one called, I don't even know, the hook was Gotti Gotti, it's like a Gotti Gotti Rolling. It might be called Gotti Gotti Rolling.
Yeah.
Anyway, just sort of random.
Mm.
So those
guys. Whatever pops up.
He's massive, isn't it? And I just haven't.
See another dude with tats on his face.
Yeah, he's got tats on his face and weird multicolored teeth.
Yeah,
XXXTentacion, I still listen to.
Would you ever do a follow up from your rap doc?
I would. I'd like
would
to.
You,
actually.
Yeah, it'd be a good, different enough time for it.
Oh,
to...
the scene's changed a lot. Mm. People getting tattoos on their face. I don't know quite why. That whole world, I just find, you know, anything that's...
Have you got any tattoos at all?
No.
Nor would you have ever?
No, I think I would. Have you got any?
I've got a few, yeah.
Have
but
you?
But facial tattoos.
Yeah, it's bold.
But maybe it'll be normal now. I was thinking about another thing on the way here, which is the way in which hip-hop drives culture, right? And so something like, a word like bling, that was a hip-hop, as far as I'm aware, coinage, I think it was BG, Baby Gangster, was it? Or maybe it was YG. Anyway, one of the southern rappers had a phrase that was all called, it was all about bling. And that's now become a mainstream word.
Yeah, yeah.
The Prime Minister used it.
Yeah.
And in similar ways, things like a word like beef, you know, now it's become
mainstream. Yeah, yeah.
So maybe facial tattoos
will
become normalised.
They'll be like the Prime Minister will have it. We'll have it written across his face, Gucci Gang or something.
Yeah. I think that saying beef, though, is less of a commitment than getting a facial tattoo, isn't it?
It's just a matter of degree in the end, isn't it? It's just... It seemed like a commitment. Yeah,
but that's right. But when I first saw rappers with, because I think it was the Southern rappers, like, that started getting these like Birdman, or like an ice cream cone.
And Lil Wayne was one of the first to get really tatted up.
And I think you're just thinking, fucking hell, that's mad. And now it's just like, people are casual about it now, man. Facial tattoo.
You're quite shocked by it, aren't you?
I am really shocked about it. I am, genuinely. I mean, I can't believe that people do it. I can't believe I can't believe there's not. When you go to get a tattoo done, obviously you have to sign a thing saying I'm fully aware of the permanency of this or whatever. Mm. Blah blah blah. I just the idea of there must be another level of that when you get a face tattoo. There's got to be. Mm. There has to be.
Do you think so? I mean, there's like buying a gun. It's like you got 3 days. We don't give facial tattoos on the day.
Yeah,
it's our policy to give you a 3-day cooling off period. Yeah. Yes. So come back in 3 days, and if you still want it, because otherwise you could rock up drunk or something.
Yeah, yeah.
There was the woman who fell asleep in the tattoo chair. Do you remember that? And woke up and her face was completely covered.
Jesus.
Because she'd forgotten to say stop. I don't know. Did you never read about
it? I mean, that is an insane tattoo studio policy. Right. That we continue tattooing until you say stop.
Yeah. presumably
she's got her eyes closed. Out, she's still
like, just keep going and I'll tell you when I've got enough. Okay, then.
Oh, man. Hip-hop grapes.
And is there anything about hip-hop you don't like?
Well, the misogyny's always been an issue, hasn't it?
How do you feel about that whole distancing the artist from their... there's two arguments here. First of all, distancing the artist from what they're talking about, and also just listening to music without putting responsibility on yourself to condone what's being said. Do you know what I mean? I mean, where do you sit on that argument?
I think it's a tough one. It's not like... I mean, someone once explained to me, it's not like singing a song. Like, you can do a cover version, but it's very, very rare for a rapper to cover someone else's rap. I think it's happened once or twice.
Yeah.
And that's because a rap is seen as an authentic expression of someone's personality and outlook. And granted, sometimes people rap... In fact, very often people rap in personas, the persona of a gangster or the persona of someone else. But it's also seen that you can only rap... The whole idea of keeping it real always hinged on you should have some first-hand knowledge, not that you've necessarily seen it or done it, but that you're familiar with the milieu that this sort of behaviour, whether it's shooting or dealing drugs, comes out of. Otherwise, you're just ridiculous, right? All of which is a long-winded way of saying, I think it's quite complicated. Like, in other words, I think I've always enjoyed the macabre side of rap. Yeah. I've always enjoyed the rap that felt it was a little bit irresponsible.
I know what you mean.
And if anything, there's something kind of
thrilling about it.
I used to find some of the sort of pious, positive rap a bit tedious.
Yeah.
You know, there was a moment when I listened to a Schoolie D album called Smoke Some Kill. And the idea that, he's not saying, until then it was all kids don't do drugs. Even rappers. You know, NWA, I don't smoke weed or cess because it's known to give a brother brain damage, and brain damage on the mic don't manage. They changed that a couple of years later, didn't they? But but the idea that Schoolie D was going to say, like, oh no, I do want you to do drugs, I found really thrilling.
Sit down on the couch to cool and chill. Crack me a 40, roll some kill. I was smoking, I was choking. My mom said, boy, you must be joking. Threw me outside, it was raining, I was soaking. That weed so damp and broken.
I just thought it was so counterintuitive and strange. And then a lot of his raps I enjoyed because he seemed to be saying, like, when you see me on the street, you think I'm going to crush you. Like, his whole rap persona was like, yeah, I'm going to come and beat you up. And I was like, yes, you are. Yes, you are. And so I think that kind of sense of danger and menace and a slight sense of irresponsibleness is not intrinsic, but it's part of what I enjoy about rap.
Yes. Did your other half listen to rap or anything?
Not as much. She doesn't. She's not rap averse, but she's not as into it.
So, because sometimes, like, I've talked about this a lot, but like my wife is not a hip hop fan, and occasionally one of those kind of tracks is a bit more kind of macabre, exciting, or whatever, violent, will come on, and she'll look at me as if to say, like, you
grow up.
You're an adult. You're an adult father. and this is what you're listening to. Like, she just, it's, do you know what I mean? It's, I almost feel, when she looks at me like that, I feel slightly embarrassed. Do you know what I mean?
It's funny because I was more comfortable with the violence, and then some of the sex I used to, made me a bit, especially in my younger days, I was a tiny bit squeamish about. So there'd be graphic descriptions of sex acts that were going down, or you're going to go down on my whole crew kind of thing. And you think, like, you're like a little bit, like, sort of pious little public school boy in me would be like, oh, I didn't think that sounds like a very good idea. You know what I mean? That sounds an unsafe. Yeah. That doesn't sound. You know, or and Tupac was slightly occasionally prone to that. And a few of the other rappers. And then sometimes it was just so over the top. Like, do you remember there was a band called Above the Law, and I think the track was called One Less Bitch We Gotta Worry About.
Yeah.
Oh, jeez. I feel bad even saying it. And it was, I think it was about basically
anxiety to do with bitches.
If only. Well, in a way, in a deep way.
Yeah.
It was about basically killing women, I think.
Yeah.
Jeez. And you just think, but it's so over the top and ludicrous. I mean, you're not going to bop your head to it, I don't think. Like, certainly I wouldn't feel totally. It's just too, it's too off the charts.
Yeah.
But occasionally it would get so over the top. It would be almost like panto.
Yeah. And then it stops being offensive, doesn't it?
Yeah, and it's no longer offensive. Yeah, it's just ridiculous.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I know what you mean. The thing is, I always find it the most embarrassed I get is when it's a skit, when it's not even part of the song. And then I think it's like some album I listened to recently, just this guy was just getting head in one of the skits and you hear all the sounds and everything.
Yeah.
Like, Biggie thinking, was bad.
Biggie
listening
had
to
that. Oh, yeah. He had like full on sex and stuff. But he's, yeah, there was skits in there.
Biggie.
Him.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm. Just Don't Bite It. Do you remember that one?
Yes, I do. Yeah.
I didn't, that, yeah, I couldn't quite. It's not really. It was never. I never felt. I mean, I listened to it, but it wasn't. I wasn't completely feeling that.
No.
The idea of a rap entirely about giving blowjobs, well, receiving them.
Yes. I also. Yeah.
Put it in your mouth. Put it in my mouth.
Yeah.
What was it?
Put it in your mouth. Yeah. Akinyele.
Yeah. Akinyele.
Yeah. But
I played that the other day.
And there's a couple of. Do you remember the Yin Yang Gang? Beat the pussy.
Yin Yang Twins. Yeah.
Beat the pussy up, beat the pussy. Like, oh no.
We could do a nice sort of remix of all the rap.
No, no, listen, I totally. Because the thing is like, it's weird, isn't it? The violent stuff, you sort of go, okay. It's the sex stuff, you sort of go, this is a very private thing.
Yeah, yeah. Shoot as many people as you want, but.
This is something you should just.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? I just don't enjoy somebody talking about receiving a blowjob. Is that bad?
No.
No matter how sonically pleasing it might be. Louis, you've been amazing. Thank you so much, man. Yeah. You've been, what would you say, best guest we've ever had?
Best guest. Stand down.
I feel like we could keep going.
I know. Going. Anna, when is your book?
Oh, yeah. The book is dropping September 19th.
Great.
So 19/9/19.
Right.
Which is a nice, memorable.
Yeah. That's great, yeah.
And, September 19th, it's called Gotta Get Through This. A little bit of rap in it.
Yeah.
Mainly my life and anxiety.
Well, it's very, very funny.
Oh, thank you.
It's really, really good.
Thanks for having me.
No, thank you so much for coming. We're both such huge fans. It's been a real honour to have you on, so thank you.
Pleasure.
Thanks, man.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com. Code PROGRAM.